Welcome back to the podcast. Again, my name is Heath Brown, and I have the real pleasure today to have read and to talk to the author of Don't Tell Me to Wait, How the Fight for Gay Rights Changed America and Transformed Obama's Presidency, Carrie Ellefeld. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Heath. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for the interesting book. Thanks for coming on to talk about it. Before we get to it, maybe you can just tell us a little bit about yourself, where you've been in the past, where you are now. Who are you?
Sure. So I've been a journalist for about 20 years. I spent the first 5 years of that working in local regional business journals. And then I went back to school, got my master's at UC Berkeley, Graduate School of Journalism, and started covering politics. And I ended up moving to New York, and the first job offer that I had in New York came from a local LGBT publication called the New York Blade. And I took it, and I thought I would do it for a year or two and then maybe, you know, try to jump back into mainstream reporting, something like that. And it just, I mean, it was just such an exciting time, actually, to be reporting on LGBT issues. And the more I reported on them, the more committed I got to the subject matter, to my readership. And that was 2006 that I took that job. By 2007, the primary between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton started to heat up, and I moved to a national LGBT magazine, The Advocate, had the great good fortune to start reporting on that primary battle, during which every vote counted, and the candidates very much reached out to their progressive constituencies, I think, in a way that perhaps they wouldn't have if it hadn't just, you know, dragged on for over a year. So anyway, and then when Obama won, I managed to get a couple interviews with him during the campaign, mostly because of that heated primary battle, which I think very much worked to the benefit of LGBT rights activists. And when President Obama won and went to the White House in 2009, I relocated to Washington, D.C. and began to cover the White House and President Obama. So that gives you a little bit of a feel. I reported, on the first few years of his presidency there, and then started, in 2012 to I was looking back at all that had happened, and there was more to come. But even at that time in 2012, it seemed to me like there had been a political tipping point on LGBT issues in Washington. And, when I came there, they were toxic going in. And when I left there in 2013, they were seen as a winning issue for Democrats. And that is the reason that I wrote the book, that I was pretty sure I had witnessed something extraordinary in a short amount of time. And so there you have it.
Yeah, no, it's so interesting. So, you've had the chance to interview the President of the United States, and now you have the chance to talk to me about your book. I'm not sure if this has been the most disappointing day for you or the most exciting day for me, but it's such a pleasure to talk to someone who's had this opportunity. I mean, so few people actually get to do this, be face-to-face with the President, and I want to talk about that. But before we get to that, before we get to some of these, the information that you collected firsthand, your book is about a transformation of the Obama presidency. But as you just mentioned, you start during the campaign. I wonder if you would recount for us. I mean, it's not that far in the past, but yeah, I found in reading the book, I was struck by the things that I have forgotten. So where were the two Democratic candidates on gay rights issues during 2008? And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this big tactical, maybe call it a mistake, the Obama campaign made in planning a particular rally during the campaign. So take us back there first.
Sure. Well, this was an all-out battle between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama for the LGBT constituency. And Hillary Clinton, when she started to sort of lose the battle, upped the ante and really started to put the pressure on by doing as many interviews as she could, especially with the LGBT newspapers and reporters, in part because that was a constituency that favored her. Somewhere, you know, in the 60th percentile, I can't remember the exact number, but I think it was around 65% of LGBT voters tended to prefer Hillary Clinton over Obama. And so she very much needed to hang on to those votes. And where they were on the issues was really pretty darn close to each other. You know, it was a little bit splitting hairs. And what I found in general was that, like most voters, LGBT voters tended to like one or the other of them more so based on their sensibilities or their style or whatever. And then they filtered all of these things, you know, all of the input through those lenses and came out with a positive conclusion for whichever candidate they liked the most. But in terms of the issues, they were both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were pro-civil unions and not supportive of same-sex marriage or marriage equality. They both wanted to repeal the Defense of Marriage Act, but this may be getting into too much detail, but Senator Clinton at the time wanted to repeal just Section 3 of Defense of Marriage Act, which was the section that prohibits the federal government from recognizing same-sex marriages. And Barack Obama wanted to repeal the whole thing. Now, depending on who you liked more, you thought one was great and one was horrible. It was arguably more strategic to just try to repeal Section 3 because Section 3 was the only section that dealt with the federal government. Section 2 was the section that dealt with states not having to recognize the same-sex marriages of other states. So that would allow more, I think, support from people who wanted from candidates or politicians who wanted the states to be in control of what they had to recognize, but wanted to make sure that gays and lesbians, same-sex couples got the full benefits of the federal rights. But if you were an Obama supporter, then you thought, Hillary Clinton was just being calculated and sacrificing the real prospect of full equality for the sake of something that was strategic and calculated. In terms of Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal, they both favored repealing the gay ban, the ban on gay and lesbian service members serving openly in the military. So they were actually quite close on the issue. And I think the issue that, or the little snafu is more than a snafu, I'll tell you that. But the problem that the Obama campaign ran up against, which is something that they would run up against later, as they planned the inauguration for the president elect at that point, and even again came up in other areas of the administration, was that they enlisted a guy named a pastor named Donnie McClurkin to head a gospel tour that was happening in South Carolina, and they had put together this sort of faith and family gospel tour in South Carolina, the Obama camp had, in order to try and woo South Carolina voters and especially appeal to South Carolina's black voters to support him in the primary. And at the time that they were putting together, I mean, this seems like a no-brainer, but at the time that they were putting together, Hillary Clinton still had more support at that point among black Americans than Barack Obama did. So they put this together, and it seems like a great idea. You have this gospel tour through South Carolina, but Donnie McClurkin was a particularly divisive figure in that he had, proclaimed that at one point he had he had struggled or wrestled with issues of gay attractions, same-sex attractions to men. And he had, I'm sort of paraphrasing here, but mm-hmm. he had yep. found God and God had led him to the right path, and that he was no longer afflicted by those attractions because of his faith, in God and Jesus Christ and et cetera. And of course, this was a real problem for the LGBT constituency and for gay voters. I mean, this was religion just over and over again had been used to browbeat you know, the LGBT folks and really and harass them. And so many folks, I think, especially in the South, just felt the bitter sting of what it's like to have the Bible used against you and something that you feel, you know, the sort of the love that you feel in your heart, what makes you fundamentally human. And so it was a real problem. And essentially when it came up, I mean, this is how I ended up getting my first interview with Barack Obama. I had been harassing them for an interview. And I often say that getting an interview with a politician is a lot like being in a bad relationship. You just throw yourself again and again and again at that person until they finally decide they need you, right? And when this sort of, when the choice of Donnie McClurkin blew up in their face, they decided they needed me. They needed a...
Let me ask you right before you get to that, because I just wanted to set up that interview just with a little bit more about the exact thing that you were just describing.
Sure.
Which is that your book isn't just about the sort of the formal politics of campaigns. You also write so much about the role of activists and really the changing landscape of digital media.
Mm-hmm.
So in just talking a little bit more about the setup for this first interview that you got, it wouldn't have happened if not for the political environment that had evolved in 2008. So I wonder if you could talk just a little bit about who some of the insiders were in the sort of the activist blogging digital media community that were able to take what could have been an issue that just sort of floated away and raised attention to it. Because if not for that, it would be unlikely that the candidate would have reacted in the way that he did. So tell us about some of those people that you must have known very well at the time.
Well, you know, so you're very much right about this, with the exception of one thing. Some of these folks I didn't know yet. I knew of them and hadn't met them, and in some cases didn't know them at all. But these were the bloggers, you know, the bloggers played a very important role, as you are suggesting here, especially in the LGBT community, especially in 2007, 2008. You know, blogging had become, I think, a real political force. But, you know, LGBT folks, and I don't have any stats on this, but I've read about it enough to have a sense that LGBT folks were sort of early adopters of the internet and using that technology to connect, right? Because especially mainstream publications and whatever didn't cater to LGBT folks because it was such a small slice of the American people. And so blogs and the internet had become a way for LGBT folks to connect and find community in a way that they sometimes couldn't find, especially if they were in a small southern town or a Midwestern town or whatever. And so they were very important. They had a lot of readership. People were very politically active in this way in terms of the readership and the comments and things like that. And so when this choice of Donnie McClurkin came up, there was a blog called America Blog. And I ended up becoming actually quite good friends with one of the main bloggers there, Joe Sudbay. But at the time, I did not know him. And the editor-in-chief of the blog at the time was John Aravosis. And I also had not met him. But he got wind of the fact that Donnie McClurkin had been chosen and had already had some of these, you know, these issues arise. And it had already been scrutinized to some extent in 2004, because I think he was invited to sing at the Republican National Convention, if I remember correctly, and you know the issue of his same sex attractions had come up in a different way in that realm, right? Which was why are we having this guy who's had you know, quote unquote problems with homosexuality sing at a Republican event? I mean, I think that was sort of the frame of it. So John Aravosis, who had a very strong D.C. following because he was D.C. based and politically based, and they wrote about mainstream issues too, but also had a very strong LGBT following. Both he and Joe Sudbay were gay, and he noted that this that Donnie McClurkin had these issues and brought it up and put it on his blog and said, this is a real problem for the Obama administration. This isn't this isn't what I would call a new, I mean, again, I'm paraphrasing here, but this isn't what anyone would expect from a new civil rights leader, the guy who's going to usher in a new civil rights era, is to have this particular singer headlining his events. And that's not only, that's not only bad optics, but it's just plain divisive. It's a divisive way. It's a divisive thing for Black Americans and LGBT Americans who didn't always see eye to eye on things. If you're trying to unite the party, this is not the way to do it. And it sort of blew up from there. Pam Spalding, a blogger in North Carolina, who had a blog called Pam's House Blend. She's Black. She's lesbian. She had a very, very strong and outspoken grassroots following, picked up on this post from John Aragosis and, and in her very pithy, very sassy way, said, this is not okay. And it blew up from there. And I think this is a situation where under normal circumstances, it may have been sort of a blip. There may have been sort of a 24-hour outcry. Maybe one of the major LGBT groups would have said, we don't like this or something like that. But it literally dragged on for, I think, about 10 days or so, getting mainstream headlines, getting coverage in places like the Washington Post and the New York Times. That was a lesson to be learned for the campaign that LGBT bloggers can actually blow something up into mainstream headlines. They're sort of forced to contend with. And that's how I ended up getting the interview, because he was taking on Senator Obama at the time was taking on so much water for this choice, that they reached out to me and said, let's do an interview.
And what was that like? This is a senator at the time. In the middle of a campaign, you traveled to Chicago to do the interview.
Yeah.
What was covered? What did you expect to discover in the interview, and what was the eventual outcome of it?
Right. Well, so just to clarify a touch, I did this interview, and this interview was actually on the phone. I did a second interview with President Obama later in the campaign, for which I did go to the headquarters.
Okay. Right.
So look, if I hadn't lived it, I wouldn't remember it either.
Right.
but anyway, so I did this phone interview with him, and the main issue there were two main issues. Did you vet this guy, right? Senator Obama at the time said, well, we didn't vet him to the extent that I would like to have vetted him. But the other issue was they decided to keep him on the tour, even though, headlining the tour, even after this blow up. And I basically said to him, and, this was not an easy thing for me to say to him. I'm a sort of white middle class American. I grew up in Michigan and very aware of the privileges that I had being born, to white middle class parents. And I'm covering a man who could be the first Black president of the United States, who has fought through all sorts of racial tensions and difficulty and whatever to rise up to where he is. But I knew this was a real problem he kept talking about uniting people and building bridges. And there was no doubt in my mind that this was divisive. And I said to him something close to, haven't you essentially, by keeping Donnie McClurkin on the tour, chosen your Christian constituency over your LGBT constituency? And he just, flat out rejected that. But this was a tension between Christians and also, African-American Christians and the LGBT constituency that would arise again and again in his campaign and also during his presidency.
Now, you, Senator Obama wins, becomes President Obama, and you have another opportunity to interview him in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And you pushed him again on the DOMA issue.
Yeah.
And by the end of the interview, you have what you describe as a eureka moment.
Right.
Would you walk us through that interview and how what sounded like it started out as a rather non-committal, typical interview that you would have with a sitting president turned into something different?
Sure. Well, so once again, I mean, there's hard work involved with getting these big interviews because you keep asking. But then there's a moment where sometimes you get lucky, right? And I had been asking that the president and his aides had not granted a one-on-one interview with an LGBT journalist during the first 2 years of his presidency, which is different from what he had done. He had done those interviews with other constituency press, like the African-American press, and he had done it with some of the Spanish language media outlets. So he ended up giving a blogger interview at one point where he included Joe Sudbe in October of 2010. This was before the midterms. White House was trying to stoke, some progressive turnout at the polls. But anyway, he had not done a one-on-one interview with an LGBT journalist. And I think really activists had been so forthrightly confronting the White House, confronting the president, that there were a lot of questions that they did not have good answers to. One was his position on marriage. One was what they were going to do on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Were they going to repeal it as he had pledged? And when they finally get, and I don't mean to credit this entirely to the White House, but it is a big win for the White House, right? I mean, there were a lot of people involved with this win, but when they finally get Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal done 4 days before the end of the 111th Congress and before Republicans would take over the House of Representatives and basically put a choke hold at that point on all progressive legislation for the rest of his presidency, they have a reason to celebrate. And that's when I get the interview, the Oval Office interview. And, you know, it's really so that he can take a victory lap, right? And they give me 10 minutes. That's what they originally allotted me, was 10 minutes. And I'm thinking, gosh, 10 minutes is nothing, given that there's 2 years that have passed and there were two more years that we wanted to get some idea, some gauge for how committed the president would be and what he might have, anticipate doing on LGBT issues. And I think they were really quite afraid of me backing him into the corner on his position on marriage equality, which was still that he supported civil unions and did not support same-sex marriage. So 10 minutes was, to me, a way of saying, and if we get into any territory that we don't like what's happening, we're just going to shut the interview down. I mean, that's not what they said to me, but that was the signal as far as I was concerned. So anyway, I plan the interview out. I do my best. I figure he's going to take, probably a 5-minute victory lap on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which he did. And I decided I would just let him have that uncontested and not rehash that history because it was a win for everyone. But then I would try to really nail him down on what else he might be able to do through his executive power, since we were going to lose the House. We were going to have a much slimmer majority in the Senate in terms of Democrats. What could he do through his executive powers to help LGBT people? And we talked a little, it was hard to nail him down. I decided I did push him on marriage, but I did not back him into a corner on it because I felt like it was so important to get some other answers on what he could do. Because, coming out for same-sex marriage would have been a huge symbolic win. But it wouldn't have brought at that point any more rights to same-sex couples for the president to come out. Huge symbolic win, but not something substantive in terms of the legal rights. So what he could do is he could do executive orders, right? He also at that point could have ordered his Justice Department to stop defending the Defense of Marriage Act. And as I mentioned before, this is the law that is prohibiting the federal government from recognizing same-sex marriages and giving the 1,100 federal benefits that flow from marriage to a couple, including immigration rights and taxes and Social Security survivor benefits and all of these things that come with marriage to help form a safety net for a couple. And anyway, so I got through, you know, they ended up letting the interview, his aides ended up letting the interview go a good bit more than 10 minutes. In fact, it got into sort of the 17-18 minute region, and they called last question. So that's when you get your final question. And so I hadn't heard him give me anything specific other than I'll use my bully pulpit to, you know, push LGBT issues further. And I didn't feel like there was anything that we could really pin to him or nail him down on that he said he would absolutely do. And so I said, well, I just asked him a very big open-ended question where I said, you know, this is a very historic time that we're living in. If there's anything that you can do over the next 2 years, what is the biggest thing you think you could possibly do for LGBT folks going forward in your power as president? And he took this long-winded answer, and at one point and I interrupted him and said, but I think people are wondering what you can do. And he said, Carrie, I'm trying to answer your question, but you keep coming back at me. I mean, you know, I had to apologize to him.
Mm-hmm.
He was kind of saying, can you just shut up and listen? I mean, that's not what he said, but that's kind of what he was saying. So anyway, I sat back. And he said a lot of different things, and still at the end of that answer, I still hadn't heard anything we could totally nail him down on. And finally, it just at the very end, when he had finished his answer, I said, it kind of just slipped out before I even knew it had happened. I just said, what about not defending the Defense of Marriage Act? And his aides were not happy with me because I had sort of, you know, thrown this last question protocol to the wind and asked him another question, which is way out of line. And he said, you know, as I've said before, I have a lot of very smart lawyers looking at this. And I think it's something we're going to have to strategize about over the coming, you know, weeks and months. And that was an absolute departure from what Robert Gibbs and every other White House official had been saying about the Defense of Marriage Act for 2 years straight, which was the Justice Department is doing what it does, which is defend laws duly enacted by Congress. And that was the party line. That was the White House line. It came down over and over again. So when the president said, I have a lot of really smart lawyers looking at this, we're going to have to strategize about it, I walked out of there and knew immediately that was an important moment. I don't know. Sometimes maybe the last question, the question you didn't plan on asking, becomes the best. Who knows?
Yeah, it's, you know, and I think, in, you know, there's so much more in the book. But what I was really struck by is how the book really serves as a training manual for how to do interviews. I think you're just so candid and honest about how you prepared to do these interviews and how, you know, how the messages you get from political handlers need to be interpreted by political reporters like yourself, academics as well, who do similar kinds of interviews, maybe with slightly different purposes. But I learned so much just from that those pieces of it. I enjoyed the book. The book, again, is Don't Tell Me to Wait, How the Fight for Gay Rights Changed America and Transformed Obama's Presidency. The author is Carrie Elleveld. The publisher is Basic Books. Carrie, thank you very much for your time today.
Keith, thanks so much for having me. It was really a pleasure.